by for Wyoming Hooking and Hunting Outdoors with your host, Drew Kirby.
Hey, this is Luke Holmes.
I am Morgan Wallen.
I'm Riley Green.
I'm Travis Denning.
Hey, I'm Aaron Lewis.
Hey, it's Luke Bryan.
I'm Tim McGraw.
What's up? This is Ian Munsick.
Wyoming Hooking and Hunting Outdoors.
It's Wyoming Hooking and Hunting Outdoors, and as we do every week, we bring in Janet Millick and the fine cast and crew at Wyoming Game and Fish Department to give you all the information that you need. And Janet, there's something happening on the river this week that really is important.
That's right. It is what is becoming kind of an annual event here on the North Platte River that started in the mid-90s, Matt?
Yeah,
The Flushing Flows of the North Platte.
The last 29 years, like, this has been kind of an ongoing thing. So it makes me think, because 29 years ago, I graduated high school. Oh, God. You start thinking about things like that and how much has happened over those years. But one of the great things that has happened over the last 29 years here is the fishery has really become world renowned.
That is right. And it is due to a lot of the cooperation that has been developed between the Bureau of Reclamation and the Wyoming Game and Fish Department to really help us secure those flushing flows.
We're doing this starting on Monday, which would be tomorrow if you're listening on Sunday, the 25th, and it goes for 10 straight days through April 3rd. And Matt, you're with us today, and how much water actually pushes through that normally doesn't push through?
Well, the water that's getting pushed down the river is water that's destined for Glendo anyway. So there's no loss of water, so to speak. It's just water that's stored upstream that has to get moved to Glendo at some point anyway. So there's a way that the Bureau of Reclamation can move that water to Glendo in a manner that happens to have a great benefit for the trout fishery.
Really, it's kind of like, and this is going to be a pretty weird analogy, but it's like taking X-Lax. If your body takes X-Lax, it forces things through at a high rate of speed.
Yeah, but the difference, Drew, is that you don't typically want to save what comes out at the end. And in this case, it's getting saved in Glendo Reservoir for use later.
Matt, we've heard reports, and it's an obvious thing, that Alcova is rising, and this is a normal situation.
Alcova gets drawn down in the fall by 10 feet every year to protect the headworks, you know, on the canal that comes out of Alcova. They draw the water level down below that level so the ice doesn't mess it up. And then they refill it again every year in April. So it's not, the filling of Alcova isn't related to the flushing flow at all. That they just make the water up coming out of Pathfinder, basically. So
with a year like we've had, it hasn't been extremely cold. It hasn't, you know, the ice came off a lot quicker. It wasn't a lot of ice time. Does that affect the water that comes down the river and the spawning of those fish?
No, not really. The where ice can really kind of bung things up for the flushing flow is that you can't run these flushing flows when there's still ice cover on the river, because it, you know, as the water comes up, it busts all that ice up and moves a ton of ice downstream, and it can cause ice jams and flooding and things like that. So, you know, we've had years, really cold years, where the ice on the river lingered really late into March, and we've had to delay the start of the flushing flow because of that. But this year, you know, obviously, I think the ice was all gone as of 2 weeks ago.
The flushing flow is that high rate of water that's pushed through. What time does that start being pushed through?
The water is released up at Gray Reef Reservoir in the middle of the night. That pulse of water travels downstream and usually gets to Casper. Like, if you're watching the river in Casper, you'll see it start to come up in like mid-afternoon time frame. It doesn't come up really quick. It's not like a wall of water or anything like that, but it's one of those deals where if you're, say you're walking on the path along the river, and you might look at the river and then you look at it 10 minutes later and you think, gosh, it seems higher. It's, you know, it's coming up kind of slowly and gradually over the course of a few hours until it peaks. You'll see, like, in the afternoon, there'll be a lot of water in the river through town, But when you look at it in the morning on your way to work, it's back down to really low flows. So
the water will reach Glendale by the end of the day, or is this just such an ongoing thing that the water is just constantly moving?
It takes a couple of days for each pulse to make it all the way down to Glendale. Gosh, it's probably 150, 160 river miles between Grey Reef Dam and Glendale. The water as it goes down a river gets attenuated by the channel, and so as it's actually slows down as it moves downstream. And so even though it's peaking at 4,000 CFS coming out of Grey Reef Reservoir, if you look at the USGS stream gauge at Orrin, which is right above Glendale, you'll see that it only peaks at about 2,000 CFS down there. But the duration of the peak is a lot longer than up here, because that it's kind of like stretching a slinky. That pulse of water gets really stretched out over time the farther it goes.
The process lasts 10 days, but it's 10 days of the water coming out of Grey Reef, right? So then it really is a couple of days even longer than that for the whole process to finish.
Yeah, pretty much. If you look at the gauge down at Orrin, you'll see it comes up real slow, but it never drops back down to base flow because of that attenuation. So if you look at the Glendale graph, it looks like a staircase. It comes up a little bit and then down just a little bit and then up more and then down a little bit. And then once the flushing flow is done a few days later, it'll do that stair step back down again.
One of the things, Drew, that I think we really want the public to be aware of is this is kind of a sneaky situation, right? So it's not like this huge wall of water comes down that you can hear and you know to kind of get back from the river. It you know, you might be standing in the river throwing the stick for your dog for an hour and all of a sudden you're stuck out on that island, or kind of, you know, if you're fishing out there or something along those lines. And so people really need to just kind of be aware that this is going on. It's not a super dangerous situation. Like Matt said, it can kind of go, you know, a little bit slow, but it does increase quite a bit. And so again, you can go from just kind of standing out there and waiting to being stranded. And so we do want people to be aware that this is going on and just be aware of your surroundings and keep an eye on the river for the next, you know, 10 to 15 days.
So then, Matt, are these 10 to 15 days of pushing that extra water down the river worth it?
Oh, absolutely. You know, we've found over the years, like a long time ago, back before 1995, where the amount of fine sediment that accumulates in the river channel, you know, you would have a natural high flow event and it would clean up the spawning gravel really nice. And then over the years, that fine sediment just keeps building and building and building in the river channel. And so the flushing flow, by doing it every year, it keeps the river kind of at this baseline clean gravel condition from year to year. It doesn't allow all that stuff to accumulate and build up over time. But then within that, there's variability from year to year. So for example, a year like last year, where we do the flushing flow, we move a lot of the real fine sediment downstream, we've got the gravel nice and clean, the trout are spawning, but then we get a ton of rain up in the Bates Hole country and the river runs muddy pretty much the entire spawning season. So you're not going to get really good reproductive success in years like that. And, you know, there's no way to predict that. And you can't really flush after the fact once the fish are done spawning. The eggs stay in the gravel for another month or two. You can't like do a flushing flow after that, because then you're going to wipe out a lot of the reds anyway. So there's good years and bad years within kind of the natural variability of what we see in precipitation we get here. But without the flushing flows, it would just get so bad that there just is no trout reproduction anymore. You know, prior to 95, there was zero wild trout production in the North Platte River. It just didn't happen. It was just too much sediment everywhere. And now at least we get some really good years punctuated by some average years and then an occasional below average year. But we've been really successful at being able to maintain that as a wild trout fishery pretty much at or above our population objective for a long time. And And the only reason we're able to do that in this type of system is because of those flushing flows. So, you know, a lot of the credit for how good this fishery is needs to be given to the U.S. Bureau of Reclamation for their ability and their willingness to work with us to do these types of habitat manipulation projects. So it's really kind of a unique deal, and it's I don't know of any other place in the Western U.S. that can do it with any regularity. You know, there's some places where in a really good water year, like say the Bighorn River downstream of Boyson, in a really good water year, they can get a flushing flow, but it's certainly not anything they can just programmatically bank on from year to year like we can.
So are there places outside of like the Boyson area where that happens in Wyoming, or is it pretty much like the North Platte and the Bighorn?
You know, I think this year they're going to try to do a flushing flow on the Shoshone.
Yeah.
I don't know that they're going to be able to do one on the Bighorn. I think that that's still being looked at. And then the North Platte.
It's a special thing that, you know, a lot of people need to really take into consideration. That's why it's become one of the best places to trout fish in the United States, and some would even say in the world. So it's cool to see situations like this. And are there any negative effects that can happen on the river because of this flushing flow?
I don't really think so, Drew. It's one of those deals like, you know, we're being downstream of a reservoir. It's what's called a tailwater, which means, you know, the water flow is regulated by a dam. And so if you think about like the upper North Platte River above Seminole, what's called a freestone river that isn't influenced by dams, those rivers have an annual cycle of, you know, in the spring as the snow's melting, the flows go way up, oftentimes, you know, 10, 15, 20 times base flow or more if it's a really wet year, and then taper off and you have almost like zero flow late in the year. And so, you know, rivers are basically designed for that. There's a whole field of study that a lot of our aquatic habitat biologists are really well versed in terms of the science about how rivers shape, how rivers form, how rivers move sediment and everything like that. So rivers are shaped based off of that natural hydrograph. And when you get downstream of a dam, pretty much in every case, there's large changes to the river channel. It tends to downcut, become more channelized. You lose a lot of channel complexity, which translates to habitat availability for trout. And so tailwaters, while they're incredibly productive from a food standpoint because of all the nutrients and things that are coming out of the reservoir, they're often lacking in spawning habitat and habitat diversity because of the lack of those flows. And so when we can mimic that natural flow, and keep in mind, like what we're doing for these flushing flows is minuscule compared to what this river would have done, you know, historically. So peak flows through Casper prior to impoundments oftentimes would have exceeded 20 or 25,000 CFS. And now, you know, we're able to get 4,000 CFS is the pulse to flush. So really important to get those to move that accumulated fine sediment out of the system. But I can't think of anything that would be negative about that.
So being that it's so controlled and regular, things are looking pretty good for 2024 and the fishing season, I assume, then, right?
It should be. I mean, we're a little bit below objective on our population up there, pretty much river-wide. And a lot of that is due to, like what we talked about earlier, with a lot of precipitation events or like mid to late spring, kind of after the fish have spawned. Kind of one of those, it's a roll of the dice, right? You never know what you're going to get for conditions. And so we've had a couple below average years in a row. And so the population has responded accordingly. So it's a little bit below objective right now. So, you know, fingers crossed, we get this flushing flow done and then the spring precipitation patterns are favorable for trout reproduction and we'll bounce back. It only really takes one good year. And, you know, if you get one single good year class produced, then that can carry that fishery for the next 3 or 4 years. So it's really what we hope for is like one or two good years out of every 4 or 5 years. And we can meet objectives pretty easily.
Good deal. Well, hopefully this is a good year. And remember, March 25th through April 3rd, there'll be flushing flows on the North Platte River. All right, guys.
Thanks, Drew.
Always a good time. Thank you.
It's Wyoming Hooking and Hunting Outdoors.
Drew and Brian at Rocky Mountain Discount Sports. And Brian, we thought that spring had sprung this week, but really what it was the fact that winter wasn't done with us.
Big old head fake out. Yeah.
It's not nice when they do that stuff to us, isn't it?
No, but it sure got a lot of guys to get their boats out of storage and get things tuned up a little bit. I actually got my boat up on Alcova and ran it around and checked things out and caught a couple trout, no walleyes, but wide open, and it was a great day.
So when I was going last week, we were at 60, 65 a couple of days, and I'm like, oh, I'm going to get the side-by-side out this weekend, and I looked at the side of it, I'm like, oh, no, I didn't get the sticker.
Yep,
you got to get the sticker.
Yeah, I had a pile of stickers that need to be put on things, between trailers and campers and trucks and the boat and a new plate on the boat because I lost one last year. I mean, yeah, it takes a lot just to get everything going.
It sure does. And, switching from season to season, you go from fishing into big game hunting, and then you go into duck hunting, and then you go into pheasant hunting. And, I mean, there's something different every month and a half that you're changing.
Yeah, I did get the goose decoys out of the garage and into the shed, but we still got another couple of weeks, or I guess another week of pheasant hunting out at the bird farm. So until that's done, then I'm going to keep all the hunting vests and the shotguns ready start prepping the boat at the same time.
Yeah, and we talked about this not long ago, but if you've been out in some of the weather duck hunting and goose hunting, and your guns have probably taken quite the hit this spring.
Oh yeah, we went through most of the shotguns already that we my 12 gauges and that kind of stuff that I use a lot of time for my big goose hunting and stuff, but we've got all those cleaned up and kind of put back away, and it's amazing how much corn stalks and dust and dirt and that kind of stuff gets ran through these guns.
Yeah, just if you're in blinds, like you run the layout blinds, yeah. I mean, you're laying in the dirt basically, so your gun's right there.
Oh yeah,
right along with you, and you come out and you got dirt on your face and that's your guns right there. Yeah, it's the poor gun. They don't get the love that they probably should.
No, we get busy and we forget things. But fishing poles are next. I mean, I can't tell you how many times someone's pulled a spool off for me to re-spool one here at the store, and it's just got a cake of dirt and old grease. I'm like, how about we clean this up a little before we put this back together?
Worm guts everywhere.
Oh gosh, yeah.
Dried out worm guts and. If maybe you want to get your line re-spooled on your reel, and that would be really that good time to do it, and you guys will do it here. And how do you price that out for people?
Basically, on the mono, it's 5 cents a yard. So, if you want to take the line off ahead of time, that's great. Otherwise, we can our spooler will strip the line off those reels, and we'll get you all set back up. But it's kind of nice. I mean, if you take the line off at home, you can kind of run a rag over the thing, make sure it's get some real oil and just kind of lightly lubricate it, just so it's clean, so when you put it back together. But we'll certainly take care of that. And I think most spools, most time it's going to cost you $3, $4, $5 to spool a line. A big line counter might be 6 or 7, but you're going to get the spool filled up appropriately, and it's going to be on there nice and tight.
And you don't have the frustrations of starting to go and then all of a sudden it slips
off. At your kid because he's not holding the spool or it fell off the pencil or
One thing that we talk a lot about here at Rocky Mountain Discount Sports is you like to fish and I enjoy fishing, and knowing the reel that you may be looking for, if you're not going to spend a whole lot of money, you guys obviously have reels for any type of fishing that you want, but also you have different grade levels as far as like expense.
Yeah, I mean, you can get a basic spinning reel for, $30 probably, maybe less, I don't know, somewhere in that $30 range, but all the way up to $300, mm-hmm. And some of those just, they're made out of different materials, so the reel itself is a lot lighter. The capacity is probably not going to make too much difference on the price, but really just how they're built. You know, they're taking a lot of design out of these things to make them lighter weight. And a lot of them will have like a $30 reel might only be like a one ball bearing system, whereas a nice $200 or $300 reel might be a 10 or 12 ball bearing system, which just makes it a lot smoother.
When you have the lower end of those, you're spending $30 on a reel. The likelihood of that lasting as long as the one that you spend at $300, will you get as much use out of that?
I typically don't see reels that like one ball bearing reels lasting, you know, 3 or 4 years. I can tell you that I've got some Fluger Presidents, which is like a $69 or $70 reel, somewhere in there, that I've had for probably close to 10 years. You know, so they're not wearing out. And I fish a lot. So I think, if you buy a quality reel, it's going to last you as long as, you know, you're not stepping on them or breaking right. handles and that kind
of
stuff.
And obviously taking care of your stuff, you know, your parents as a kid were like, leave your bike out in the middle right. of the yard. It's going to rust up, you know, it's going right. to be not right. But, you know, making sure that you take care of that stuff. And you guys actually have people here in the store that if you maybe want to get a new reel or maybe you want to work on the reel that you have, that, you know, knowledge is very thick here at Rocky Mountain Discount Sports.
Yeah, you know, and a lot of guys come in with, you know, reels that they might have picked up at a garage sale mm-hmm. or something, and they're like, yeah, you know, can you fix this? I'm missing this spring. Well, boy, I mean, the days of like a reel repair shop, you know, is pretty far and few between. And so really a lot of those reels are kind of unfixable unless you're, you know, troubleshooting parts yourself and maybe getting some parts off of eBay or I don't know. It's usually some kind of goofy spring that you can't even figure out how it fits back in there, you know. But yeah, the nice part, you know, is, you know, we've got all the reels out there on display, so a guy can pick them up, they can spin them, they can, you know, kind of look at price point. You know, some guys want to match their reel to the rod, you know, color wise and that kind of stuff. I'm more fit and feel, just like, you know, lightweight, trying not to get too big of a reel. But then there's guys that are going to be fishing up on the rivers that are trolling maybe with an open face reel. And so you want a bigger, you know, something that'll have a little bit more line capacity for a heavier line.
So really, you know, if you're not familiar with fishing all that much, but you like to do it, and you get a little overwhelmed when you come in and look at the whole wall of reels, you know, they can definitely help you out here.
Yeah, I like to ask, you know, like kind of what fishing you're going to be doing. Are you going to be doing stream fishing in the bighorns? Are you going to be, you know, casting, you know, spoons up on Alcova? You know, there's going to be a difference in what we're going to recommend for you.
So come on in and check out everything that you need. And don't forget, because we're in the season where we don't know if it's going to rain, snow, or be sunny, windy day, you guys are carrying the Striker rain gear now. Yep. And you even, you know, you have the under layers and the wool socks and all the stuff you're going to need in your boat.
Yeah, and the weather can change in a heartbeat. Like, you know, I got up to Alcova last week, and we got there about 10:30 in the morning, and it was iced over on half the reservoir.
Oh, wow.
And so we decided to go up the canyon just to play around up there, and it was beautiful up there, no wind. Got back on the main lake an hour and a half later, no ice. Clear. So,
welcome to Wyoming.
Welcome
right?
to Wyoming.
Come on in, check them out here at Rocky Mountain Discount Sports for all your fishing needs.
It's Wyoming Hooking and Hunting Outdoors.
Back at Rocky Mountain Discount Sports, where fishing is a hot topic right now because we're all itching to get out and fish. And Brian, this week you got to take advantage of having your boat out and ready.
I got it out for one short afternoon. Yes.
Hey, then you put it right back in. Huh?
Yeah. It was a little chilly. We just wanted to run the boat, make sure everything was batteries held up through the winter and that mm-hmm. type of stuff. And we got on Alcova and got to play around a little bit, ran the boat around, let it idle a bunch, and caught a couple trout, really nice trout, but no walleyes. But it was good to get out.
So I've seen a lot of people, if you go on Facebook and you follow any of the, you know, the fishing or hunting sites that sure. are on Facebook, you're seeing a lot of guys that are, you know, showing off that they've had the boat out, they've done this and that and the other. And I think now we're going to start seeing that a lot more, because we're going to get into warm afternoons and guys are going to go out after get off. And I saw down at the Glendoe that we've been talking about, you know, Mark Green, who was taking over there, mm-hmm. that they finally got the docks kind of secured now. And they've seen some fishermen catching some pretty good catch out there.
Yeah, I've heard some pretty good stories. I mean, all over, really. I heard talk to a guy that was up at Pathfinder this last weekend and had a really nice limit of fish up there. Guys at Alcova have been doing pretty good on the walleyes and the trout, and guys down at Glendoe been kind of hit or miss, but I've seen some good fish come out of there. You know, the biggest thing I guess I want to make aware is that, you know, this is the time of year that those fish are spawning. Mm-hmm. You know, and whether it's the trout on the river or the walleyes in the reservoir systems, I mean, we got to really kind of to preserve our, you know, resource. You know, we don't have game and fish stock in a lot of our reservoirs and those walleyes. I mean, we need them to reproduce in order for us to have good years in the future here. So those big girls, you know, when you catch them, let them go. You know, that's the one thing that this time of year, it's like it's a good opportunity to catch some good quality fish. But those fish could be laying millions of eggs, and that could hurt our fisheries down the road.
Which also you have to add in the flushing flows begin this week and go for the next 10 days. So by the time they get to Glendale, we're talking 12 to 14 days. So these water fluctuations are going to go. And then, you know, really it's going to be a whole different ball game for a couple of weeks, I think.
Yeah, and, you know, it depends on what we get for additional snow. But, you know, runoff has been pretty minimal right now. So the waterways of the river and the reservoirs really have been pretty clean and pretty clear. I mean, you can pretty much fish just about anywhere you want. So the flush is really going to help that. It's going to get those trout more active into that spawning mode, and it's going to help get some of that sediment out of the system as well.
And I know last year after the flushing flows is when we had that big snowstorm, mm-hmm. and then the runoff came, and it was muddy for a lot of the season. So, you know, hopefully we don't get that, and hopefully, you know, we get a year of ease.
Yeah,
leading into the next season.
Yeah, and you know, I think the fishing reports are looking good. I think the good numbers of walleyes in Glendale and Pathfinder, and with the water levels at Pathfinder, I think that's going to fish really well this year. Seminoles sitting at pretty good levels right now too, and most of the water systems that are feeding into our reservoirs are in over 100% right now. So as long as we keep getting a little bit of moisture, I think we're going to have a great year.
So when you were fishing this week, you said it was kind of slow walleye-wise. You mm-hmm. got some trout or whatever. Are they still in the winter mode where they're maybe slowed down just a little bit? Or are they kind of – because it's been, you know, nice weather – are they just confused?
It's hard to tell. I mean, Alcova for me is like my arch nemesis. Like, it's nice because it's close, but man, it just kicks my butt. And for the walleyes anyways. And we ended up, we really couldn't fish the walleyes the way we wanted to. It was so windy that, you know, as soon as you cast your line, you got a big bow in your line. Mm-hmm. So when that happens, you know, it's really hard to feel that, especially when you're fishing a minnow presentation, really hard to feel that bite.
How's the minnow situation right now? Are they pretty stocked up and ready for anglers?
Yeah, you know, we're fortunate that, you know, we order statewide minnows, and so we usually have a really good, you know, I keep minnows year-round. I mean, there's even in June, July, and August when local trappers, you know, aren't successful at getting minnows, we have them. It varies. You know, we always order the large fatheads, but, you know, size always varies a little bit. Sometimes they're awesome. Right now they're really pretty good. And other times, you know, they're moving through so many minnows that a lot of times we get, you know, inch and a half, 2 inch minnows. But right now the numbers are good. So I think we're going to be fine for the spring. And, that early bite, you know, can be pretty good with a jig and a minnow or even just a slip bobber presentation.
So really, by the time the first Wyoming Walleye Stampede gets here in it's just over a month and a half away, the, what is it, the 11th and 12th or the, something like Mother's that in Day May. Weekend. So, it's great, great scheduling.
Great scheduling. Yeah, you're welcome.
But then I feel that that guys are really, like I said, chomping at the bit to get out. And I saw even over at Boyson where there was good ice there. Really is open water and people are fishing and catching over there.
Yeah, we were checking out the, it's kind of fun to watch the state park cameras because they've got cameras like at Glendo, it's up on Two Moons Campground. So you can kind of see like majority of that south end of the lake. But at Boyson, you can see the campground or the parking lot. So you can count how many people. Yeah, like the other day I was on there and there's like eight boats parked in the parking lot. Like, oh, those guys.
You know what the funniest part to me is? How many times have you got on the back of the boat and you just kind of, relieved yourself a little bit? And then you got
It'd have to be a pretty good walking. Camera.
Extra zoom in, please. But, where do you go to see the cameras?
I think it's just through the state parks website. And then there's actually one section on there that says webcams.
Oh, okay. Yeah. And go check them on. Yeah.
Yeah.
Another way to put a tool in your toolbox there.
Yeah, spy on your buddies.
That's right. Now, why is he up there today, dang it?
He's in my hole.
If you're getting out, make sure you stop in here at Rocky Mountain Discount Sports.
It's Wyoming Hooking and Hunting Outdoors.
We're back on Wyoming Hooking and Hunting Outdoors. It's Drew, and you can always get us on the radio station app. Click on demand and hear all of our shows. We're sitting with Casey Vollmer today. Casey is the owner of Victory Wildlife Artistry, and you have done hundreds of mounts for hundreds of people, and you've done different kind of mounts. But this art and artistry, it doesn't happen overnight, does it?
No.
And it takes you a long time from start to finish on an animal. Can you kind of run us through the process and the procedure from the time the animal gets to you to the time you deliver the animal?
Yeah, absolutely. And there are a lot of steps that, even myself as a hunter, before I started getting into this, I wasn't necessarily aware of. And so there's a lot of factors that come into play. And, like I said, it starts in the field with the hunter and their preparation there. And so then when they bring it to me, we're going to get it checked in. We're going to do some measurements on, eye to nose and the circumference of the neck so that we can try to recreate that as most accurately as we can as what you saw in the field. So we're going to take those measurements, look at the condition of the hide and the hair. And then from there, it goes right into production because we're going to start turning ears. We're going to be fleshing everything, making sure that the hide itself and those hair follicles are going to be preserved. So it's going to be salted and then turned and dried, and then it's going to be sent off to a professional tannery. And to us, that's really important because that quality of the tan is going to determine the longevity of your mount, too. And so we do professional garment tans and make sure that that's the highest quality leather that we're getting back. And so, and sometimes we're at the leisure of the tanneries. There's not very many left, and that's definitely a skill that's to be desired in our industry for sure. And so, that might take quite a few months to get the tans back. And so once we do get those back, we remeasure because the tumbling and the preservation process of that tan is gonna shift it a little bit, might stretch it a little bit more. And so we just want to make sure that's the most accurate measurement that we can. From there, we're going to order forms and materials to get ready. And then once those come in from our supply company, we're going to go right to work and, go get right on there, putting the glass eyes in, doing clay work and epoxy work and making sure that, everything fits properly on your form. And so we usually have it dry for a couple weeks, just fine tuning, making sure that everything is exactly where it's supposed to be from the eye placement and the eyelids to ears. Everything needs properly dried first before we can get to work on the finishing aspect, which is going to be your epoxies and your painting and the finishing, making sure that it looks its best on the wall.
Now, Casey, one thing that, is really interesting to me is you don't get just one mule deer. How many different projects are you working on at the same time?
You know, it kind of depends. I mean, sometimes we'll have nights where there's six deer that get checked in, you know, right after hours or, yeah, you know, at night after everyone gets back in from the field. And so that stuff needs taken care of as quickly as possible. And I might still be in the process of mounting up a deer, or, you know, turning hides. And so, you know, on a normal day, we have four or five going at the same time, just depending on what stage they're in.
Wow. So you're just going kind of like a doctor in an emergency room where you're going from room to room to room to room and back to that room just to kind of do a little bit of work on each?
Yes, absolutely. And it's a lot of prioritization. You know, you have to kind of look at, you know, what needs taken care of right away and a lot of time management. And because I do own my own business, I have the luxury of having some weird hours sometimes. Yeah, and so, you know, if something needs taken care of, we're going to be up working on it, making sure that it's where it needs to be.
Do you have a particular animal that you enjoy working on more than others?
You know, it might be a PR way of saying it, but they all mean a lot to us, and it's an honor to get to do anything, whether it's big or small. You never know what somebody's story is, and so we take tremendous amount of pride in anything that comes in our shop. And so whether it's something like an antelope or a deer, something you might see more of, all the way to our African kudus that we've done, our axis deer, or bears, every piece is a little bit different artwork. And it's something different every time. And so we absolutely love the detail and getting to work on a lot of different things.
When you go into the artist mode of this, because there's so many different steps of it, but when you get to the final, all right, here's what's going on, here's what I'm going to do, how much do you sit and think about it? I mean, is this something, do you like talk to the hunter and be like, okay, well, here's kind of what I think. What were you thinking? And kind of go back and forth.
Yes, absolutely. And that's something I didn't necessarily experience in my past with other taxidermists for my personal mounts. And so that communication aspect for me is really important. And so I might actually bug them a little bit more than they want, but I just want to make sure that they're getting what they want. And again, that's that memory of a lifetime that they're going to have on their wall. And so, you know, if there's something that might not be working quite as well, or I really think that it'll, you know, look bigger or better in a different pose, that's something that I will be in contact with them with, or, you know, any problems that might arise, I'm in communication with them at every step.
Once you get the final project done, say somebody moves into a new house and they're like, oh man, this just isn't going to fit. Is there any way that I can change stuff on my mount?
Yeah, there's always, you know, that opportunity to remount something. And, you know, taxidermists are always looking for spare capes, too. And so even if, you know, for the hunters out there that might just want a Euro something, if they want to bring in a spare cape and it's caped like you would for a mount, taxidermists are always going to be really appreciative of that, because there's something that might come up, or someone that, you know, maybe harvested something a long time ago and it didn't quite have that longevity that they were looking for. They can always bring that rack back in and we can remount it in a way that they're looking for. And so that's always something that we'd entertain doing.
Which is kind of cool that you can do that, you know. But, you know, when you think about the artistry that we have here in Casper, you go through the entire city and you see some forms of art, but one form of art they probably don't think about is taxidermy. And it's a lot of time, patience, effort, and I'm sure a few tears here and there too.
Yes, absolutely. And that's why I say it's that literal aspect of blood, sweat, and tears. And, you know, that's even when I go to bed at night, I'm still thinking about that and dreaming about the little details. And that's something that we're all encompassing. You know, it is about those fine details, making sure that every little thing is as perfect as it can be. And, you know, when you see some different taxidermy on the wall, you might not know why one looks better or worse than the other, but it's in those fine details there. And so we want to make sure that we're doing everything we possibly can just to make sure that artistry is as perfect as it can be.
If someone's listening now and they are going out on their first hunt, what is the best way for them to really learn how to cape the animal properly and what they need to do out in the field so that they don't ruin it?
Yeah, absolutely. And there's a lot of homework that goes in, just like you're going to be researching your area. You might go out scouting. You should also do that ahead of time with your taxidermist. And, you know, there's a good handful of us here in Casper. There's some really great people and even in Wyoming as a whole. And there's opportunity to, you know, get your mount to where you really want it to not only fit into your budget, but also fit into kind of the vision that you're looking at. And so I would highly recommend, you know, doing your homework, reaching out. Most of us are more than happy to have you come stop by the shop, look at what we have going on, and maybe discuss some of those, you know, things like prices or the details. And a lot of us are more than willing to show you how to cape something out too. And so I would definitely say reach out to those taxidermists so that you know the way that they might want it caped, or, you know, everyone's a little bit different. But it's really important to make sure that there's always enough cape that we have for a shoulder mount or a pedestal mount. And so those cuts are really important in the quality of the mount that you're going to get at the end. So please reach out to your taxidermist, do your homework on that, and just make sure that it's the doing the right thing in the field for when you're bringing it to your taxidermist.
Very good. Go to Victory Wildlife Artistry. You have a Facebook page. Your email address is there. Easy way for people to reach out to you.
Yep. We're a little bit newer on social media. We weren't sure we were going to go that route, but we're really proud of the stuff that we're sending out. And so we do have a Facebook and an Instagram, and we try to update that with some of the stuff we're working on. And please, yeah, email, call, reach out. We're more than happy to discuss anything with you from your hunt to brainstorming some ideas or even helping you cape something out. So please reach out.
Very good. Get there. Check it out. Victory Wildlife Artistry. And Casey, thank you.
Thank you, Drew. It's been a pleasure.
Wyoming Hooking and Hunting Outdoors with Drew Kirby. If you have a question, want to make a comment, or have an idea for a show topic, message us on the My Country mobile app. Wyoming Hooking and Hunting Outdoors.